best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, there are about 600 venomous snake species worldwide, and I hope you never run into one. A new study looks into how some venomous snakes attack their prey. Vipers, elapids, and colubrids all have different behaviors when striking, and we will learn all about it. Listening to the best of our knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Have you ever come across a venomous snake? Well, I hope you never will. There are about 600 venomous snake species worldwide, and 200 of them have venom potent enough to cause serious harm or even death. Scary, right? Well, these snakes have different ways of attacking and striking their prey. Elapids, colubrids, and vipers are some species of venomous snakes that all have different techniques and behaviors for attack or to defend themselves. These snakes have evolved to make sure their venom seeps into their prey as they either rapidly bite, move side to side with their fangs, or clamp onto their prey to immobilize or kill. I spoke with Alistair Evans, a professor of biology at Monash University in Australia, to learn more.
So there are around 4,000 species of snakes around the world, and about 600 of them are venomous. So not every snake you see will be venomous. Obviously, there are snakes like pythons that are not venomous at all. They capture and kill their prey by constriction, by wrapping their body around and closing tight. But the ones that we were looking at fall in the three main families of venomous snakes. They are the vipers, the elapids, and the colubrids. So the vipers are probably the ones that most people are familiar with, and they are many of the snakes that are venomous in the Northern Hemisphere. And so they are interesting in that they often prey on mammals, and they have fangs that fold out of their mouth. So their fangs are so long, they actually fold them back so that they're sitting back parallel in their mouth. And then when they open their mouth to strike, those fangs basically wind down and are ready to puncture into the prey as soon as they get there. So that's one of the things that we really wanted to be able to see in detail and look at it from a number of species. The second family is the elapids, and they are some of the most venomous snakes in the world, and a lot of the snakes in Australia are from this family. And so they have fangs as well, but those fangs are at the front of the mouth and they're fixed, so they don't move. And that means that the fangs tend to be shorter. That doesn't necessarily make them less deadly, but they are just a difference in the way that those fangs are arranged. And then the third family is the colubrids, which is actually the largest family of snakes. But they tend to have the fangs that deliver the venom at the back of the mouth. And that seems like a strange place to put fangs. Because, well, why not put them right at the front where you're just about to grab anything? But this is one of the quirks of evolution, I guess, that when they evolved, that's where they were. And if you need to be able to envenomate your prey, then you've just got to open your mouth wide enough and get it back towards the back of their mouth. And so what we wanted to do is to be able to compare the ways in which each of these families of snakes lunge towards their prey from a stopped start, how they lunge towards the prey, how fast they go, and then when they reach the prey, how do they put their mouth towards the prey, and how do they puncture their fangs into the prey.
So something that immediately caught my eye when I was reading about the research was that snakes, just in general, have some of the most fast reflexes. But I believe when I was reading venomous snakes have that even more so. So I'd love for you to kind of describe about and talk about these fast reflexes that snakes have.
So snakes are predators, and predators often need to be able to catch their prey. And there's a few different ways they can do that. One is by literally chasing them down, which is being able to move and run as fast as your prey. Another is to be an ambush predator. And so you can hide And be ready to strike as soon as the prey gets close enough. So you're basically waiting for the prey to get to you. And so different snakes have different amounts of that sort of balance between chasing and an ambush. And so we wondered if those speed of movement, the speed of the strike, and sort of the reflexes are faster in those snakes that are ambush predators, where the speed right at the beginning of that movement to be able to basically go from stationary to capturing their prey will ended up being faster than those that are chasing prey. So when we were doing our experiments, we were really just looking at that, starting from sitting still to moving us in order to make that strike.
So, how did you conduct your study into these venomous snakes?
We wanted to look at as many different species as possible in order to get an idea of the diversity of snakes across the world and across those three main families. And after looking around Australia, where there are the most venomous snakes in the world, it turned out to be easier to go to Paris because, and in Paris, they have a venom production facility, which basically means they keep more than 50 species of snakes, where they are milked frequently for their venom, and the venom is used for medical purposes, including things like making anti-venom. So they keep all of those snakes in the one facility, a large number of species. They have obviously professional snake handlers, so they know how to deal with all of these snakes. So we went there in the end because it was going to be the easiest to make our experimental setup in that facility, basically the same place where the snakes were. And we could do everything in a controlled environment, the same environment for all of the snakes. So we set up an experimental arena. And so that was basically plastic clear glass on five sides, about 1.5 meters or 5 feet by a meter or 3 feet on five sides. So it was open on one side. And so we would put the snake on the ground inside the arena. And we had a long metal pole, the sort that they use for snake handling. And on the end of that pole, we put a cylinder of what is medical gel. And so this is basically like ballistics gel, sort of Mythbuster stuff. And so it's fairly soft, and the snakes are happy to bite into it. We heated that gel, so it was about 38 degrees. So again, looks a bit more like something attractive or perhaps a predator. A warm-blooded object that was coming towards them. And so we would move the fake prey towards the snake, sometimes getting close, sometimes not. And we would wait then for the snake to strike. So we had set up along the long side, which is perpendicular to where the snake was striking, two different cameras that were at a slightly different angle. And we can calibrate those cameras so that we can reconstruct them, anything that moves within those two camera frames within 3D. So we can also set up multiple cameras around so we get a really good view of everything if there was anything really that we wanted to see. But our main focus was to be able to see the movement of that snake in very fast speed from the side. And each of those cameras was set to record at 1,000 frames per second so that we could look at every single detail. So we put each of the 36 snake species within this within this environment. We had them strike at that prey at least three times so that we had some replication for how fast they went. And then we could compare how fast each species went, how fast the different families went, and whether there was any different behavior that we could observe in terms of whether they were going to strike immediately or a bit slower. And then after they had actually punctured their fangs into the prey, did they have any other variation in the way that they behaved then?
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. If you're just joining us, we're learning all about venomous snakes with Alistair Evans, a professor of biology at Monash University in Australia, to learn more. So could you possibly explain, because I'm curious, because you looked at venomous snakes, but I know that non-venomous snakes also must attack or have a defense mechanism to some degree, right? So I'm curious, how do snakes that are not venomous attack? Is it in a similar fashion? Do they also kind of bite and strike?
They can also bite and strike, yes. But also you have the pythons that are really focusing about holding their prey and wrapping around them to constrict them. But one of the reasons that we're looking at venomous snakes is that a lot of my research revolves around how teeth are used in feeding. So I'm particularly interested in the action of the teeth. And so the fangs are the main teeth that we see in these venomous snakes. And so we wanted to see at high speed and in great detail how those fangs were deployed and how they sort of fold out in the vipers and how they then strike and then move the fangs after they have struck the prey. So the teeth was one of the key parts that we wanted to do. And many of the other non-venomous snakes have much smaller fangs or not really enlarged fangs at all.
I'm glad you mentioned the fangs because my next question kind of deals with that. And that is about the venom specifically. So I was curious about the venom as to kind of the injecting part of it, because when I was watching the videos, it was so cool, but it's kind of terrifying at the same time. I was like, wow, but seeing the venom just kind of like squirt out so incredibly fast into this medical gel, I would love for you to just kind of talk about that sort of aspect of it all.
Fangs are really important as the delivery system of the venom. So the venom is created in a venom gland or at the back of the jaw, near the back of the head. And it has ducts that run through the side of the mouth, in the lips basically, to the position of the fangs at the front. And the fangs are really cool because they're basically like little needles. They have a hole through the middle of them and a hole at the top and the bottom. And so the venom is directed so that it squirts into the top of the fang. If the fang is injected into the prey, the fang goes all the way through, and the venom goes into the prey directly. So it's quite an amazing system to have evolved, and it seems to have evolved independently in several different snake families. And so we were able to watch that process very closely. You wanted to know a little bit more about venom. I can't say a lot about venom, but the venom in most snakes, in some ways, it doesn't matter whether it kills or it just immobilizes. The main idea is that snakes often strike their prey and then move away so that the venom has the opportunity to take effect. Usually it will kill the prey quite quickly, and then the snake can come back. It can either follow it, or if the prey hasn't really gone anywhere, it can move up to it, and then it can swallow the prey whole. So that's usually what most of these snakes will be doing in terms of their feeding behavior.
Something that I'm also curious about is that, do snakes usually attack only when they're provoked, or is there other factors that can go into them possibly striking or attacking something?
So there are two main reasons why a snake might strike. One is to capture its food. So it'd have to recognize that is a food item by its size and its shape, its movement, its warmth, things like that. But snakes can also strike as a defense mechanism for something that they think is going to injure them. And sometimes those strikes can be different in those different situations. In the defense strike, sometimes they will just open their mouth and really more threaten that they're going to strike, because there's no use threatening the prey. If you want prey, you just strike it. But as a defense mechanism, they may threaten. They also, when they bite down, they may not actually inject venom. So that's called a dry bite. So that once they've bitten in, they don't inject venom because they figure that's actually, you know, it may not be enough to kill the predator, as long as they are able to tell the predator that it's not really worth their time. It's going to be difficult. give them a strike and then move out of the way and hope that the predator says, okay, well, that really wasn't worth it, was it? And goes off. So we know that in some species where that difference between a predatory strike and a defensive strike might be different. Here, we didn't really have the opportunity to study that. So the strikes that those snakes did, they may be feeding strikes as we're intending, or they may have been defensive strikes. So that's a bit of a limitation of our study that we couldn't really distinguish those, but we did our best to try to capture some aspects of the ways in which they move. But not be able to say, oh, this is definitely how they feed, and this is definitely how they defend themselves.
So, when I was reading the research, there was a specific technique or behavior of striking talked about, and that was the bite and release, which I think you kind of touched upon already. But if you could talk about that a little bit more, it's interesting to hear that the snake, you know, is like, okay, I already struck, but now I'm just going to chill for a second, knowing that my prey is eventually going to be dead or immobilized. So, I'd love for you to just talk about that a little bit more.
Sure. When we compared the three different families and their different prey acquisition types, we saw that there was a bit of a difference between the families in the behavior of when they're approaching the prey and then when they bite and then move away. So sometimes, if they would strike, they would quickly puncture using their fangs, inject, and then move away. Sometimes they would perhaps not really get exactly the angle that they wanted. And the vipers in particular are quite interesting. They have very, very long fangs, but those fangs are also mobile. And so once the fangs have sort of partly punctured, the snake can do what's called walking the fangs and actually lift one fang out of the prey, move it further onto the prey, and then puncture it again, and then move the second fang upwards and into the prey again at a better spot so that they're more got a better hold on it and better place to inject the venom before they do so. So that's a I really wouldn't be, want to be someone who was being held and bitten by a snake as they do that. They're going to do that more likely with prey where they know that it's important to inject the venom rather than the defensive strike. So it's unlikely to happen. But we were able to watch that walking of the fangs over the prey in the vipers in particular, in a lot of detail. Many of the other two snake families, what we found was that leopards often would sort of repeatedly bite, it seems. So they're not necessarily letting go, but they sort of bite down quickly. And this may be just to make sure that they have got a secure purchase on the prey, or it may also be helping to inject the venom because the venom ducts and glands are right next to the jaw muscles. By closing the jaws and contracting the muscles, that is actually the thing that then pushes the venom out of the glands through the ducts and into the fangs. So that may just be a way in which they're concentrating the way in which they move the venom into the prey. And then the third family, the colubrids. We only actually had one species of this, or two species that we studied in some way. And these are the ones that have the fangs at the back of the mouth. And so we thought, well, how are they going to do this? And is there something different they're going to do? And what we found in particular was that once they have bitten onto their prey, they actually move their jaws sort of side to side. And because they have a row of teeth in front of the fangs and a bit behind the fangs, that cut into the prey or cut into the gel and made these sort of long wounds in the prey in the gel, and that presumably means then that the venom is able to get into the prey more easily because their fangs are really quite short. They want to make sure that they still cause a wound in the prey that the venom will go into. And so that was quite a difference between the three families and the way that they use their fangs, and that's never been really recorded in high speed before.
You're listening to the best of our knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. I've been speaking with Alistair Evans, a professor of biology at Monash University in Australia, to learn more about venomous snakes and the way they attack and strike their prey. So what do you believe that we can learn from all of this? Like, protection-wise for snakes, but like also for us, like we do see that snake attacks do happen, and more often than not, it's an accident. So, like, does this research aid us in any way, as well as the venomous snakes?
I think there's a lot of things we can learn, either directly or indirectly, from the study. One is we really want to understand the diversity of snakes. So snakes do a lot of different things. I think a lot of people just look and say, ah, that's a snake. Maybe it's a different color. Maybe it's a different size, but they all are snakes and they're all deadly. First of all, they're not all deadly. And second of all, they are doing different things. They have their own ways of finding food, eating, or, you know, what they eat. And I think that's one of the fascinations of biology, that we do have this diversity. They're all able to survive, find their food, live in the environment. Being able to understand the differences between these species is important for if we do want to conserve them. And a lot of people say, why would you want to conserve snakes? Snakes are such a fundamental part of many environments. We would have, plagues of small rodents or other animals if we didn't have snakes. They're very important in the way that they structure the environment, and those environments have evolved and, have continued to act using the snakes as part of their mechanisms to keep everything in check. So that's really important. In terms of humans, we've always known that snakes are fast, and that, this really gives us some numbers behind that. And I guess one of the things that we found was that snakes that are those ambush predators, they tend to be the fastest, so as we would expect. Snakes that feed on mammalian prey, warm-blooded like us, they also tend to be faster. And this makes perfect sense, because if you've got a prey that is warm-blooded and able to move quickly and react quickly, you want to be able to react quickly yourself. And the larger the snake, the faster they typically were. So that means you've got more muscles behind you. You can actually get up and move quicker when the conditions are optimal. The distance was quite right. Not too far, not too close. But then trying to understand about how this affects people, we could be quite confident that you will never outrun a snake. So people think, oh, if I just grab it behind the head, it'll all be fine. It moves faster than the blink of an eye. So, within tens of milliseconds, it can be from standing still to at you and back again. Before you've even seen it, it's already back. So it's not worth the even trying or even considering being able to either defend yourself or try to grab the snake. So snakes, on the whole, do not want to be anywhere near you. They know that you're not prey. They know that it's not worth them. And so you will really want to just make sure that the snakes know that you're there. And so by moving in an environment that, when we go walking through the country here, there is the possibility of snakes on a warm day. If you stomp your feet, you'll never see a snake, because they can feel the vibrations in the ground. They go, ah, that's something big that I don't want to be near. And they'll go, they'll be gone. And if you do see a snake, it wants to get away from you just as much as you want to get away from it. So just leave it alone and you will be absolutely fine. The majority of strikes, the majority of times that people get bitten by snakes is on the hands. And that's obviously because they are reaching towards the snake. And so if you're not doing that, you're very, very unlikely to be bitten. The ankle is one of the other places that is. It's because neither of you knew that you were there until it was too late. So that is unfortunately going to happen sometime, but making you aware that they're there, keeping away from places where they can hide, long grass, etc. Having the threat even of being bitten by a snake is pretty rare.
So I'm curious, what do you find the most fascinating to you about this research that you've done?
I think being able to see exactly how the vipers deploy those fangs is fascinating. So I'm not really a snake expert. I'm talking a lot about snakes, but it's some of the things that I've learned over the last few years in doing this research. But the weapons that they are, I mean, they're basically the delivery system for the venom that is being injected into the prey in order to them to be able to do anything. They don't have hands and arms, so they've got to find their own ways of doing it. But the folding out of those fangs in milliseconds, positioning them so that when they strike, they're as ready as possible to be able to put that into the prey, and then repositioning them. And then using them for their ultimately often deadly purpose is quite awe-inspiring.
And then finally, what are you looking forward to researching into next regarding this topic or a new adventure? What's up for you next?
I do a lot of research on other components. I am working with a student at the moment who's looking more at fossil snakes and understanding more about the snake body form. So snakes are very long, and the way that they're very long is because they have many vertebrae or backbones all the way along their body. And when people look at snakes, they go, "Oh, they're all the same. They're just lots of little, the little backbones all look the same all the way along." Quite different to us. We have ribs only in some part, and we have a sort of lower back. All of those are fairly different, and so we're trying to understand how those different vertebrae along the snake body are different or how similar they are. And we have the possibility of using this research to understand more about snake evolution in looking at fossils. So when fossils of snakes are found, we often just find their backbones. But everyone says, "Oh, they're very similar," or "How could we identify a snake species from those?" So in this very detailed study of the vertebrae, we're getting a better idea of how we might be able to identify snakes individually across different environments and through time at different fossil sites. And this will give us a better idea of how long snakes have lived in particular areas, which ones have evolved when, and that sort of thing. So that's a different aspect of snake biology and evolution that we've been looking at.
That was Alistair Evans, a professor of biology at Monash University in Australia. His research was originally published in the Journal of Experimental Biology. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1831. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Madeline Reynolds.